Hey guys, this is Carl Jacob in New York.
And Aaron Brown in Minnesota.
And this is Power in the Wilderness.
You know what, Carl?
What's that, Aaron?
Cars were the key to Victor Power's success. And the reason is because as people clamored to drive these new, exciting vehicles, Victor Power made a world where people could drive their cars comfortably across the Iron Range. And you know, some of the same families are still selling cars on the Iron Range today.
Are you talking about Hibbing Chrysler Center and Ford of Hibbing?
I am, and also Grand Rapids GM.
Well, it was sure nice of them to financially support our episode today.
It sure was. We appreciate it.
And thank you to Hibbing Chrysler Center, Ford of Hibbing, and Grand Rapids GM for supporting today's episode of Power in the Wilderness. It's the story of Hibbing, Minnesota, Bob Dylan's hometown.
And our hometown. And of the young lawyer, Victor Power, who beat the world's biggest corporation to lift the town from poverty.
It's part history, part mystery. It's also a serial podcast, so if you're listening for the first time, go back to episode one or you're going to be lost. When we last left Vic, he just won a milestone case against the mines that set a legal precedent for the citizens of the town to finally have some power over their corporate overseers.
He convinced the town that their prosperity was tied to their rights, not just the will of the iron mines, that if they stuck together, they would all do better.
And in doing so, he kept the people from rioting.
And from tarring and feathering Vic.
When the mines laid off all the workers in retaliation for the case.
And all of this before Vic is even an elected official, just 10 years after being a blacksmith's assistant in the mines.
There's an adage that we've encountered repeatedly in our research of early Hibbing that says, if Vic Power had a pig, everyone in town would have a ham sandwich.
The day that adage was coined may never be known, but we can make an educated guess that it might have happened on or about March 13th, 1913.
This is the day that Vic Power stood before a crowd of more than 5,000 people that had been rallied there through a half-page ad in the Hibbing Tribune and by word of mouth through Vic's immigrant networks.
Earlier that day, the front page of the paper listed the many reasons why the mayoral incumbent, Dr. Howard Weyrich, should be reelected in the face of this last-minute opponent.
So, Dr. Weyrich, he was in that same position of village president for the longest time.
Our friend Erica from the Historical Society.
But because he was this doctor and this agent of the mining companies, I think it really set the stage for Power to play to what his strengths were that you guys mentioned in that second episode, was that he was a man of the people. So you have this long reign of, you know, when we talk about corporate insurance and, you know, all these things they were doing for the miners, but really they see him as this person who's from the mining company and is in charge of the town. So it really kind of set that tone for Power to come in, and he's helping all these people on the side, and he's talking to immigrant groups that nobody else talks to. And then he comes in and runs, and they're like, hey, this guy is a man of the people. He's for us.
So through this method of using his coalitions, he was able to keep the city calm throughout this whole process. And what we didn't say in episode two is that at this point, I think he decided, though he would not admit it in public, that he was going to go after the mayoral seat. He wanted to take over the town. So while he's fighting this battle with the mining companies, and while he's having these conversations with all of these groups of people, he very likely knew that part of this process was getting their trust so that he could run for mayor. And he does run for mayor, but nobody knew it was going to happen until 3 days before the election.
There is a sense in town of dissatisfaction with Weyrich, but everybody believes that he's invincible, and so nobody wants to run against him. And in 1912, the previous year, the progressives had tried running a candidate and had lost. Not badly, but bad enough that it looked like it wasn't worth trying. But there's still this attitude in town of, like, we can do better than Weyrich. We don't have to listen to the minds as directly as Weyrich does.
Basically, from what I understand, the progressives to be, and this is my personal takeaway, is they understood that in order for the Republican ideology to flourish, there needed to be people who weren't struggling in order to lift up the Republican ideology. And that is, in a lot of ways, a combination of socialist and Republican, which is what I describe Victor Power to a lot of people. He was a socialist Republican, or a Republican socialist, which I guess at the time, according to what I've learned through this research, because of course I'm not the history buff like you are, Aaron, means progressive. That's what progressive means.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. You're not wrong in how you describe where the progressive movement is here. It's a movement that's classically liberal. It comes from the idea of reform.
Now there's a change in the weather, there's a change in the sea, there'll be some changes, man.
It's the industrial age that's been around for a few decades now, and it's all of the destruction and human destruction that has been caused by the mechanization of society and the mechanization of cities and the growth of cities, and all of the slums and the problems and the perils that face society. The progressives believe that rather than unfettered capitalism with no restraint, that there was a better way to make a society. But that movement has no figurehead. It's searching for a leader. And what Victor Power provides in a very coordinated way is a late boost of enormous enthusiasm. So the administration gets a little spooked and they run the front page ad, look at all our accomplishments, many of which were started late in the term because of the coming election. In other words, they had dragged their feet for the first 9 months of the year. And then the last 3 months, they started to do some kind of a last-ditch effort to show they were doing something. Well, on the next page of the newspaper is a half-page ad, and it just says,
Voters look. The letters are almost as big as the half-page.
Yeah.
They're huge.
And underneath is a simple sentence that says, the matters discussed on the front page, in other words, the administration's ad, will be discussed tonight at a mass meeting at the Armory, which was the biggest place you could go in town at the time.
What a genius piece of PR, because you don't know who put the ad there.
Yeah.
You know, people might have gone there thinking Weyrich was going to be speaking.
And who walks out but the still young and charismatic lawyer, Vic Power.
Beaming after his victory against the mines.
Yep. And he had just days, just maybe a week after getting the news that he had won the Leaned case against the mines, and this was well known in town, the triumphant lawyer walks out in front of a crowd of thousands.
It ends up being the largest public assembly in Hibbing ever, right?
To that point, yes.
Yeah.
If Vic Power would break his own record many times going forward, but this was the largest gathering of people ever in one place in the village of Hibbing, came to the Armory that night, packed to the gills. The thing I think about constantly is the confidence it would take for Victor Power to say, all I need is a speech to everyone, one speech to the whole town, and I'm going to win. Because I am going to convince them. That's a remarkable amount of confidence in a speech. And by all accounts, by all understanding, he delivers one of the best speeches of his career. Like many aspects of Victor Power's career, the legend is there, but the specifics are thin. It was a very convincing speech, and we can say that it's convincing because after only running for office for 3 days, he doesn't just win the election, he kicks Weyrich's ass. He just absolutely swamps him. And so does his whole ticket.
He got more than twice the votes, right?
Yeah, it was 2-1. So you go from an incumbent who's been safely winning elections for 5 years, every year an election, and he's been winning them by a fair margin, and really nobody can touch him. And then Vic comes along, announces 3 days before the election.
And creams them.
It's a three-way race because the socialists are there and they get like a small percentage of the vote too. And nevertheless, he absolutely kills Weyrich and his whole ticket gets in. It's a whole-scale change of administration in the village of Hibbing.
Right, because you're not just voting for Vic, you're voting for everyone on the ticket.
Yeah, because at the time they were using the ticket vote system that Weyrich himself had set up to keep his people in power.
Oops.
And it was over. Vic was the new president of the village of Hibbing. A title commonly referred to as mayor, and he was Mayor Vic. He would get to put his own people in power. It was a very different time. See, being mayor of a village like Hibbing meant that, you know, your people got installed at every level of government. So Vic controlled the police force, the fire department, the works. And all of this power that had been centralized under Weyrich to aid the mines was now in the hands of the lawyer who had just beat the mines. And so this is the very dramatic circumstances that happened in 1913.
Can you imagine how the mines are just shitting themselves when this happens?
Yeah. And the reason I think that he waited to run until so late was precisely to give the mines no opportunity to organize against him. He wants them to kind of be lulled into a sense that it's Weyrich in a walk. Don't worry about it. Weyrich, Weyrich, Weyrich. And by the time the mines realize that Vic is serious about running,
all they could do is take out a front page ad, which they do.
They paid good money for that, but that wasn't enough. Because of Vic's connections in the newspaper world, he was well liked by the newspaper editors of town. He knew that they were doing that, which is why he could run the Voters Look ad on the very next page. So when you look at the front of the paper, oh, there's the admin ticket. Okay. You know, when you turn the page, Voters Look, what is this? It's a remarkable strategy, and it's just, you couldn't do this today, A, because not everybody reads the newspaper the same way.
B, because there are no newspapers.
Well right, but even if you can't really do this online the same way, you can't keep a secret like this, and you can't get everybody in town to show up to watch a speech. You might get them to watch a video, maybe, but to have such a dramatic event that brought the whole town together and got them all on the same page in such a way was really the key to Victor's success. And really, it's how he would govern throughout his time in office. And he uses the strategy of surprise and the flip of momentum to secure legislative victories at the state capitol, to secure, you know, unexpected deals that would solve problems very strategically. He had a gift for this sort of political theater.
Yo.
Hey, Carl.
I just got your message.
Yeah.
So, do we have some good news?
Well, you remember how I was going to have this meeting with the woman about the book?
Yes.
The book is gone.
What do you mean the book is gone?
She calls me and cancels the meeting because, and this is what she said, they lost the book. They had the book, they held the book, but they don't know what happened to it.
They lost the book. How do you lose?
She said there were a lot of people passing through. She wonders if it got picked up. She wonders if it got put in the bins that were donated because they were donating truckloads of books to different thrift stores. They don't know what happened to it.
Well, what thrift stores? Should we go look?
it was the Veterans Thrift Store. There was like five of them. Goodwill. I don't know. She thought someone probably picked it up that was interested in it, and that so she was calling some people, but she had no idea where it is. She's flying back to Seattle or someplace, and they sold the house, and it's gone.
what are the odds of this happening? Like what?
Well,
it seems too deliberate to be an accident. It seems like, I don't know. I mean, we could speculate all day long about what their actual intentions are for the book. Do you think because you're interested in it, suddenly they became interested in it and had a change of heart and now are keeping it from us? I mean,
they or someone else who passed through that house looking for, you know, looking through the old stuff became interested in it. I that's more likely. It is, of course, possible that it just got lost. Those situations are, you know, complicated.
Right. We can't be like, listen, we know you have the book.
Yeah, I'd love to have something to threaten people with, but there's really nothing to threaten. They've been nice people. I don't think that they're up to anything, and even maybe nobody is, but it just feels kind of weird that here we've gotten closer to something real, and we have it pulled out from under us.
All right, well, I guess we'll talk later.
Yeah, catch you later.
I don't know if you heard, Aaron, but I was literally sighing with myself almost in sync after listening to that phone call again.
Yeah, the feelings just all come rushing back, don't they? I do have, an update. I mean, we did follow up on this conversation about this book, and what it was is an autobiography of sorts written by Walter Power, Victor's older brother. And it was set aside for me for when I was supposed to meet them and pick it up. But other people did see the book and it confirmed that they had seen it. I kind of contact traced my way back through, and they still don't know what happened to it. We never did get our hands on that book, though I did talk to a man who had read it some years ago and got a very, very thin kind of Cliff's Notes of it.
How did the person who read it get a hold of it?
It was this very copy of the book. This was his family. And he was a nephew of the woman who had it. What it was is the house was originally owned by a woman who worked as Walter Power's maid. And he had self-published this limited run of books sometime in the 30s or 40s and had some left over. And he had just given her one. And she put it like you would with your boss's autobiography. She just put it on the shelf somewhere. There it sat until not only did she die, but her nephew moved into the house and lived a full life, and then he died, and then this house was sold. So
that's a great illustration of how old this story is.
Yeah, I know.
And how remarkable it is that this book survived that long without getting chucked.
Yeah.
Like, who cares about this book? We do, obviously. It's
right.
A gold mine at the end of the Vic Power rainbow for us, but to any other human being, why would they want a book whose topic was, as I understand, about the tax law
yeah.
or the tax fight for the mines, which is very central to our story.
Well, the guy who read it said, oh, you wouldn't be that interested. It's just a bunch of boring tax stuff. And I'm like, but this is the most thrilling story of tax law ever told.
You know,
that's the story we're telling.
You know, that's funny. I was mentioning this project to a friend of mine here in New York. And she goes, that sounds like the most fascinating and dramatic story about taxation that's ever been written.
Yeah, exactly.
She's like, who knew tax could be so fun?
Well, they use tax as a way of bridging the story of people and power of people. So it may not have been the gold mine, we hope, but just anything written by one of the people we've been researching, it's so hard to find. That's really how this whole story is.
You know that there is likely something in that book that seems like an unimportant story to other people that will be a huge piece of the puzzle for us.
It could be.
It's almost certain that there's one thing in that book that could completely change or illuminate something that we've been struggling to put our finger on. And this is just an example of the many times things like this have happened to us while we've been researching the story over the last, what has it been now, 6 or 7 years? I'm losing track. But this reminds me also of the interview that you were doing with a fella who whose family was very close to Vic's family, an older gentleman living in Hibbing, who, after a series of two interviews, suddenly said, "You know what? I've said too much," and concluded his interview with you and has never responded to your inquiries since.
Yeah, there's this almost, it's almost lore. It's almost like unspeakable stories of the past. And a lot of times when you dig down, it's not necessarily something that we would call, a secret that can't be told. It's just that I think there was such a culture of silence around what happened during and after Vic's life, that now that we're digging at it all these years later, those who have any premonition of it may not know the details, but they know that there is a desire to keep the story quiet. And that seems to permeate everything we've done.
Yeah, there's another interview that we did with another gentleman who, in order for us to even get the interview, we had to go through a series of long pitches to him.
Mm-hmm.
To assure him that we wouldn't divulge any information that would paint Vic Power in a negative light. And there wasn't even much substance in terms of painting Vic Power in a negative light that even came out of the interview, which is the most frustrating and fascinating part.
The mystique surrounding the story is way bigger than what the story is or ever was. There are things that are very interesting that we don't know and might never know, but the point is, a lot of these people we're interviewing weren't alive at the time. They're telling their father's or grandfather's story more than their own. And
It's so old.
They're protecting it for reasons that they don't even know.
And then, of course, you know, there's the conclusion that could be obviously jumped to, which is there's some sort of conspiracy going on of silence.
The Knights Templar theory, yes.
Yeah, or similar, right?
Yeah.
And it's not helpful when one of your potential interviewees, who seems very excited about sharing some information with you about some things surrounding Vic's death, which is very elusive to us, goes cold. And then once we get a response from them, it's not from him, but one of his relatives, he starts an email chain with us that ends in some cryptic dialogue about the Masons.
Yeah.
In language that we can't even understand.
Right, in Masonic language, using those kinds of phrases. And it just leaves you with like, well, you know, Vic wasn't even a Mason, so what is this about? You know, what the hell
is
going
did,
on
he
here?
He was likely the target of investigation by people who were in the Masons in Hibbing. As we know, the Masons were closely aligned with the mining interests.
That's true.
The Elks were sort of the merchants and miners side of things.
Yeah, Vic was an elk. He was a grand exalted elk, in fact.
And then there's not to belabor this, but I really want the people listening to this podcast to fully understand the struggles we've had, not only telling the story because it's so old, but because of this conspiracy of silence or whatever the hell is going on, you know? Vic Power has journals that were given to the state library by his estate when he died. And, you know, they're billed as journals, but when you read through them, they're just very curated, almost like day planners where, you know, they have clippings of news articles that, you know, tell some of Vic's story, largely the story of his legal victories. But they're definitely not journals, and they definitely seem to be very sanitized in a way that would paint Vic the literally only remaining piece of his legacy in a positive light. And then there's the story of his, and this is just lore at this point, his personal papers all getting destroyed other than these journals after his death, his house being bulldozed to the ground, and the development community that he was working on being aggressively, you know, squashed and bought by the mines so that no one could realize his vision. The fact that he has no family, he's got no kids, and no even like remote relatives that we can talk to, and the trail that we've gone down of the one person who is a remote relative. I mean, we knew more information about his life than
they
did, which
yeah.
is always the case. So here we are, you know, surrounded by nothing.
Yeah.
And the very little pieces of information that exist either conveniently evade us or are a part of some kind of organized conspiracy to not be revealed to us. And the answer we might not ever know.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
Yeah, and in fact, the conspiracy, if there was one, was probably forgotten by those involved. Except, you know, obviously there's a chance someone alive knows more than they're telling us, and we may yet hear from them. But really, it's a huge story because you couldn't avoid knowing about Vic Power in reading through the press of the time. So they couldn't erase him from history because of what he did. But every other connection to him was severed and really kind of turned to dust. It really says a lot about how stories survive through time and how much things like a community wanting to commemorate a person mean, and how much having your own family members talk about you after you die, how important that is. Because frankly, it's also rather telling that Walter doesn't write a lot about his brother after his death and really is really reserved in talking about his brother. But yeah, the missing book, the various emails and attempts to get people to talk on the record to us about what their family knew have been really challenging in a way that I wouldn't have anticipated. And I think it only speaks to the complexity of Victor Power as a character and how he was seen many different ways in life and in death.
I'm Carl Jacob.
I'm Aaron Brown.
And you're listening to Power in the Wilderness.
For more information about the show or to listen to past episodes, visit powerinthewilderness.com.
Peebles, but then they got closed down and now our mall is like almost empty except for Joann's. Everyone loves Joann's. Shopping and Hibbing, we don't have many options, but we've got a couple good like boutiques like Nita Brook, and what's that one that starts with an M? Moxie.
When I buy something, and this is kind of how I encourage people to shop with me as well, I would rather you spend money on one dress that you absolutely love and you will pull out of your closet in 5 years and still wear than like 10 pieces of crap that are going to have the tags on in 10 years.
This is our friend Suzanne.
My name is Suzanne Ryan, and I own and operate Moxie in Hibbing, Minnesota.
And what is Moxie?
A women's clothing boutique. I hate the use of the word boutique because that's kind of gone rogue lately. So I always like to say shop. When you used to talk about a boutique, it was a place like Vera's or Saks or probably the Mercantile or something that had a little bit more behind it.
So the Mercantile that Susie is talking about here, which eventually became the Itasca Bazaar, was the most successful department store in Hibbing, Minnesota during Vic Power's era. And we were excited to discover that this business was owned and operated by a woman named Dottie Power, the sister-in-law of Vic.
She had started, when she and her husband first moved to Hibbing, the Bazaar, which was kind of a dry goods general store. And it really developed into a very sophisticated shop, what we would now call a department store. And she cut her way in business doing something that the mostly male shopkeepers were not as well attuned to do. She catered to women as customers whose clothing needs were different than those of the men who ran the town. And she anticipated this. She was also very well tuned in to fashion and the developing fashion industry in New York.
Dottie would take the train to New York City in the early days of the very first fashion shows in New York. And she would go to all the fashion shows and she would buy lots of clothing. load them into train cars, and bring them back with her to Hibbing. And as soon as she would get off the train, she would walk down to the newspaper, describe her experience of going to New York, give everyone a review of the fashion shows, and then give ideas for how to wear combinations of the clothing that she has. The paper would go out and women would flood into the store and buy up all these clothes.
And sell them at a reasonable price. And that just made her remarkable in that very few people in Hibbing could even do that and know where to go and how to handle fashion and how to assess it. She did. She had a very keen eye.
What's interesting as I hear you talk about this is that it's a little bit like that for me in a way. Traditionally, there's a couple of different ways currently businesses are getting goods. And I would say more traditional stores like myself, like a store like Bender's, would go to market. I most often go to Chicago. However, the workaround, the modern workaround, I think the equivalent of what she did is what I have been doing the last maybe 5 years or so of the 12, which is sourcing through social media. There's a lot of brands that I've found either by independent reps. So on a small scale, they're a little bit smaller than going to like a giant warehouse, clearinghouse kind of, or actually the artists or the creators themselves directly through an Instagram page. When Etsy for a while had a wholesale option where you could connect with makers on that level. And so it is important to me to source things that aren't everywhere. So it's interesting that you said she kind of bypassed the catalog or bypassed that wholesale, because that's in a way what I've been striving to do the most of.
The debutante slouch. We're still in Paris to see these afternoon gowns. Milady on the left wears a gray crepe dress, tiered skirt with a side drape setting, and featuring a rounded neckline blouse with dolman sleeves. On the right is a sleeveless flower print with first appearance of the cloche chapeau, designed not to blow off an automobile. Come into the garden now for a look at some cocktail dresses. The model on the left, an off-the-shoulder creation. And remember, this is 1917. On the right, crisscross stitching relieves the severe black. Yesterday's newsreel brings you a forerunner of the new look in the old days.
Because of her foresight with the women's clothing, Dottie became so successful that she was able to buy out her competitors. And she eventually bought out her main competitor, the Itasca Mercantile, and merged the two companies to form the Itasca Bazaar. And the Itasca Bazaar becomes a place for the women of Hibbing, Minnesota and the Iron Range to gather to not only shop and buy things that they need, but also to talk. So in the same way that Vic has the coalitions of the male immigrant workers from all the different communities, Dottie Power, his sister-in-law, is his liaison to the women of the community. And even though Dottie is doing this work on behalf of Vic and spreading the word of his eventual candidacy for mayor and the ideologies that Vic wants people to know, the women are presumably taking these conversations home with them and speaking with their husbands about it and further influencing potential votes for Vic. It seems that maybe he didn't need that amount of influence, but it was sort of a insurance policy against his speeches that he would do that were already very persuasive. So this is just another indicator of how he has left no stone unturned and has made sure that everything that he wants to do is fully realized through every possible avenue that he has at his disposal. Now, that will eventually become actual votes when the women gain the right to vote.
So here's what's remarkable about Dottie Power's situation. So she can't vote. The drunk who stumbles in front of her shop and vomits on her window can vote. The shop boy that gets sent out to clean it up, he can vote. The manager who tells him to do it can vote, but the woman who employs and hired that manager can't vote. And another remarkable thing about this time is that women had limited rights when it came to owning property and taking out loans. And that's why Dottie and Walter's arguably strange relationship for the time comes into play, because her husband is one of the owners of the Merchants and Miners State Bank. And she doesn't have to worry about loans. And her husband, Walter, Victor's brother, does not interfere with her business. It is part of their personal and professional relationship that Dottie runs the store. And so she created a world where, despite her lack of rights and privileges in this society, she had the same power as her male competitors. And she did it through her own making.
One of the things that is notable that you pointed out, Aaron, in reading the newspapers is that every wife of every other prominent male citizen in Hibbing, Minnesota at the time, when referred to in the newspaper, is referred to by their husband's name. Say, you know, Mrs. Jeffrey Bean, for example.
Sure.
Dottie Power is always referred to as Mrs. Dottie Power. The only married woman in the society who refuses to allow the paper to print her husband's name instead of hers.
And the reason is because she's the newspaper's largest advertiser, and they are financially dependent on her. And so if she says to call her Dottie Power, that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, that does not go unnoticed by me. Every time I vote, every time there's anything that goes on in politics, it is not that far removed from the fact that if it were a different decade and not that long ago, I wouldn't be able to own this business. I wouldn't be able to have my own bank account. I wouldn't be able to make my own decisions. And so I love hearing stories of women trying to circumvent it, really.
For women who had no rights to vote or be a part of the leadership of the town, society was their parallel universe where they got to have some power and influence. And women saw Dottie as their hero, I think. She was a brusque woman, tough. Maybe she wasn't their friend, but in many ways, I think she was their hero. By her getting that fashion and selling it in Hibbing to the wives of people who work in mines, to immigrants, she was saying that this town was worth something, that it was worth it to put your money into a dress. And what this meant for the people of Hibbing is that women could afford a really good dress for church, for special occasions. Wealthy women could afford one for each day of the week. And what this required at a municipal level was clean streets. You couldn't have muddy pits for women to walk through. They needed clean sidewalks and crosswalks. And so it was a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts that as the women of town began to enjoy the lives of what women were purchasing in larger cities, these dresses, these petticoats, these, you know, beautiful stockings and things that
hats,
you could buy.
Opulent hats. Fur hats. Which yeah, Dottie, every photo we have of Dottie, she has an opulent fur hat on.
Yeah, she's always put together. So this means that when the city is considering paving streets, adding expensive sidewalks, street lighting, this is something compatible with Dottie's business goals. Because if the streets are clean and a woman can walk from her house to church in downtown and to the school and to her friend's house for social hour, she can buy another dress and know that it'll stay clean and that it's worth it. It's a good investment. So even though the business of running a shop and the business of running a village might seem unrelated in their day-to-day activities, Victor and Dottie's goals were entirely compatible. And that's, I think, one of the most important parts of the story is the way commerce and economic growth become the power that generates Victor Power's political coalition. And everybody's getting wealthy and everybody's doing better and the fashion is beautiful. The women are beautiful. The newspaper editors in very sexist terms refer to how much better the women of the village look than the women from other villages on the range.
Oh, man.
And it's a thing that makes the town desirable. People want to move there. And if women want to move there, that means they'll marry men from Hibbing. And as we may have established in previous episodes, and you should know, that the men of Hibbing were a rough sort. Not always model husbands, but if there was a better lifestyle in Hibbing that was evident, women would want to move there and marry the men of the town, which were no different than the men of the other towns.
Huh.
It's just something that made the town attractive.
So just to be clear, Dottie was married to Victor's brother, Walter. Remember, Walter was the mayor in 1903, well before Vic became mayor. And it was during this time that the streets first got dramatically paved, as we discussed in episode one. Now, Dottie and Walter are married this whole time, so you can only imagine the kinds of conversations that they had. I was envisioning this conversation where Dottie is basically taking Walter to task, saying, now that you're the mayor, you got to pave these streets so that I could sell more dresses. And that being the motivating force behind why the streets got paved in the first place.
And yeah, it's entirely possible, because this was the time when Dottie started going out east and shopping at the fashion shows.
So funny.
And she would have gotten back to the train station in Hibbing, and you have to walk up 3rd Avenue to get up to her store. It's a few blocks. And you can imagine Dottie getting off the train and having just walked on this, you know, 5th Avenue and Broadway, gone to take in plays, and she was just in the greatest city on earth. And then she'd get off the train in Hibbing and probably say to her husband, the mayor, get your crap together.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, what are you doing?
What is this
Why
place?
Do I have to walk through this mud? That's so fascinating.
This is trashy. We need to fix this.
It's interesting to also note that Vic understood that in order for Dottie's business to do well, that the women needed money to spend. So there's a direct correlation between that and the people of the community getting paid well, which is not something that I think politicians nowadays think about so much, where when people have money, they spend it. Seems like simple economics, but you know, in speaking to the coronavirus, no matter what you think about the stimulus, you can't ignore the fact that the stimulus everyone got definitely kept the economy from tanking radically, you know, because people had money to spend. Yes, it saved a lot of people's lives too, you know, like people were able to pay their rent, but also some people were able to spend a little bit on buying new clothes and things, and that's really what kept the economy going. It's the same stuff, man. The same stuff in early Hibbing.
And it was so clear because U.S. Steel was the big corporation, and when they hoarded the money as they wanted to do, the money very clearly left town. It went out to New York and Cleveland. It went out to the high societies of another place, another world. But Victor's coalition were the shopkeepers in town. And when people had money, they didn't just spend it at Dottie's store. They spent it at all at the hardware store. They spent it at all the stores. And as Hibbing became more attractive with the streets and the lighting and the arts and the parks and the community, Hibbing has the reputation growing of being the most attractive town, and Dottie's the best store in town. So there's thousands of people who come to Hibbing to shop. And that is all part of that economic growth. It's an example, if you like, of capitalism and what capitalism can do, but it's also an example of the buying power and the importance of the middle class in driving a local economy.
What would be your takeaway from this conversation we've had about this?
I think it's just really fascinating how, you're right, there is such a cyclical nature to all of this. And it's interesting. I kind of sort of knew that there was somebody who did something, and I knew that there was historically more, you know, women's boutiques around here, and that there was a bigger local business community. I knew vaguely of it, but I think it's very interesting to think about the change that was really enacted in the area because there was this woman who had an idea and a way that she wanted things to go, and she just kind of made it happen. There wasn't, you know, she had the connections to men, obviously, but it really was, it sounds like it was really something that was very driven by her will and her determination and her attitude to just build this up. And I feel kind of a connection with her, because I feel like that's kind of what's gotten me through, is just you have to have a certain level of determination and of stubbornness to do retail at all. But I think especially in a smaller town, especially as a woman. And it's interesting to hear how much her story kind of mirrors mine.
We'll be right back. I love Dottie. She's such a great character because she's, you know, like Vic in a lot of ways in terms of her place in society being exemplified as something that is persevering against all odds. You know, like Vic, she is able to carve out this place and use the legal structure that was designed to keep her down against itself. And, you know, and I've had these fantasies early on in researching this story that perhaps Vic and Dottie had some kind of relationship that was beyond sister-in-law, brother-in-law. As we research it more, I'm not so convinced that that was the case. But it seems like Vic and Dottie had a very close relationship in terms of manipulating the society to their favor. And it is very clear that Dottie was very supportive of everything that Vic does. One example of that is, I forget what year it is, but one year that Vic is running for mayor, Dottie gets a bunch of custom thimbles made. That, what do they say on them? They say vote for Vic or
win with Vic.
Win with Vic, that's it. And she hands them out, right? At the bazaar, yeah. When people come in.
It was later when women got the right to vote. And the first year women could vote in a Hibbing municipal election, Victor Powers running for re-election. And the thimbles say, win with Vic.
The thing that first really inspired me about Vic Power when I just started to dip my toe in the water in discovering who he was how inspiring it was to know that there was someone who was able to look at what was going on around him, strategically place himself in a position of power, and then fight to the death, arguably, but in his wake left unquestionable change for the better in the most cases. And to know that someone today, growing up in Hibbing or Virginia or Grand Rapids or Eveleth, could be that next person, could be the person who fully understands what's going on around them and understands how they can create change. You know, we do feel like we're in a moment where we need something like that in this country. Something that can inspire joy and progress and, in some cases, uncomfortable change. Change that's hard to win, but will ultimately be better for everyone living around us. And you can't help but take inspiration from Vic and from Dottie and all the people who supported them and what they did in early Hibbing. And take pride in the fact that you live in a place with that kind of legacy, a legacy that's been buried. But, you know, we're telling the story now. And one of the reasons we're telling the story is that we want the listeners of this show to either be inspired themselves to talk about this legacy and talk about the potential that you have, or inspire someone else also to talk about this legacy and to possibly create change. I know I can't deny admitting that that's one of the reasons why I love this story and one of the reasons why I want to tell it to you. I feel an obligation as a storyteller through my work to focus on Northern Minnesota and how it has these legacies that are sometimes buried and forgotten and has these rituals and cultures that everyone kind of takes for granted and doesn't really understand how unique they are. And this is something unique that is uniquely ours as Northern Minnesotans, and something we should be proud of and inspired by.
If you think about it, Victor Powers Hibbing already produced some people who are pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
One of them is a governor, Rudy Perpich, who was the Iron Range's first governor, and he grew up in the aftermath after Vic Power died, but in the world that Vic Power had created, and became really a very influential political leader. But also after him came Bob Dylan, who changed the world in ways that most anybody familiar with the 20th century can understand. The only musician, rock and roll musician, to ever win the Nobel Prize for Literature, came out of this same stew. And Bob Dylan would go up to North Hibbing, the old town, and look at he could feel something. He wrote about this in his liner notes. He could look around at the ghost of an old town. And the ghost of Vic Power, I swear, I feel him up there. And you look around and he felt something spooky that he couldn't address. And anyone who's an artist or creates knows that that feeling in your bones that something needs to come out of you is real and is how things are created. And that is what Victor Powers Hibbing was. It was that itch to create, to build. And even when the local population in many ways forgot that, it's still there. And people like Bob Dylan and people who visit Hibbing, frankly, today, who sense it, can feel something happened here. And it's hard to explain. We're trying to explain it. We got multiple episodes, and you can argue whether it'll be possible for us to truly explain this feeling left behind by this moment in history.
Do you know what it reminds me of?
What's that?
Have you seen Frozen 2?
No, I haven't. I've only seen the first one.
You gotta watch Frozen 2, man.
Oh, man, okay. Elaborate, please.
You'll thank me. You'll thank me. One of my favorite movies of what was it, last year?
Frozen 2? Oh, that's, you don't hear that.
Seriously,
much.
I was so disappointed with all the indie films coming out. I was like, this is all bullshit, man. I need to watch a real movie. And then Gaius was like, oh, hey, let's watch Frozen 2. And I watched it, and I was crying. I was like, this movie's so good. Maybe it's just a commentary on how jaded I am about movies, but I think there is genuinely something in Frozen 2. The salient point is that there's a whole through line that kind of ties the story together that is about the land and the spirits of the land being upset about how there was a loss of memory. And there's a discovery during the storyline that water has memory. And Elsa has the ability to use her magical freezing powers to extract memories from the water of the land to learn about the past. And, you know, you can laugh all you want about the fact that it's a Disney movie and it's for kids, but there was something so profound about that piece of that story's through line that I just resonated with so truly that it just reminded me of the ghosts that you were talking about and that Dylan talks about.
Well, we're all dealing with the same water that existed before. It's a cyclical thing. Northern Minnesota is water rich. You still read about this and how we've got so much fresh water. And it's a part of the story. That's what attracted the original people to this region in the aftermath of the glaciers. This was a place where there was lots of water, food that grew on the water. That's the Ojibwe legend. The food, go to the place where the food grows on water. It's wild rice. And this is all part of the story. And of course, Hibbing is near the three-way watershed, the place where a drop of water breaking on a rock can flow either to Hudson Bay, to Lake Superior in the Atlantic Ocean, or to the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico. And it's one of the few three-way watersheds on the continent and in the world. And it was always a sacred place to both the Ojibwe and the Dakota before them and others before them. And this is the place where all this happened. And it really doesn't feel coincidental that so many significant elements of humanity have converged in this place, and that the battle has always been about resources and how humans interact with the earth. And, you know, Victor Power, I highly doubt, spent a lot of time thinking about the memories of water, as we might have learned about it.
Well, he clearly didn't see Frozen 2.
He hadn't seen Frozen 2. Alas, had he, yeah, perhaps his life would be different. But he did enter into the story, the continuing story of human beings in this place, an entry, which is that if we are to take from the land, as people have done, that should be shared. And that reflects the peak of his political being, the best of what Victor Power had to offer. And it really defines these next few years we're going to describe in the story, in what he does in a very short time, taking Hibbing from a pretty nice little place in the woods into the biggest village on earth, as they would describe themselves later.
Power in the Wilderness is produced by Aaron Brown and Carl Jacob, and edited by me, Carl Jacob.
The show is made possible in part by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
And thank you to Hibbing Chrysler Center, Ford of Hibbing, and Grand Rapids GM for supporting today's episode. Special thanks to Suzanne Ryan, who sat down with us to talk about her store, Moxie, in Hibbing.
Special thanks to Tucker Nelson for additional research.
Field audio from this episode was recorded by Jessica Berggren. If you'd like to hear past episodes of Power in the Wilderness,
or if you'd like to see pictures about the people and places we talk about, you're going to want to check out our website, powerinthewilderness.com. It's really cool.
We'll see you next time on Power in the Wilderness.
Lonely, your heart will break like mine.